This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
The agreements that the Government of National Accord in Tripoli have signed with Turkey brought in an actor who's able to engage other international actors, such as Russia mainly, in order to bring about a change in the Libyan status quo.
That's Esam Omish, president of the Libyan American Alliance on Libya's ceasefire. Details coming up also. Suspected al-Shabaab militants kill three teachers in northeastern Kenya. And Cameroon has deployed at least 1,000 additional troops to its crisis-prone English-speaking regions ahead of local council and parliamentary elections. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. French President Emmanuel Macron this evening hosts counterparts from five Sahel countries to reassess their joint fight against the militant extremist attacks. In the meeting at Pau in France, Macron hopes to build greater international support for the effort to end the increasing violence. Journalist Nicolas Pinot has been following the events in the Sahel and the French response. He spoke today with my colleague, Kate Pound-Dawson.
Well, President Macron wants to make it clear that all the G5 countries, which is Mauritania, Mali, Niger, Burkina Faso and Chad, they really want to have French troops on the ground fighting alongside their troops against jihadists in the region. And why is that important for him is that in recent months, France has been seen as kind of an occupying force in these countries. And public opinions have been more and more defiant. You can see mistrust against French troops, accused of not doing enough to fight jihadism in the region. So that's why President Macron made that decision after the death last November of 13 French soldiers involved in a helicopter crash in Mali.
Now, what is some of the background to this summit? How bad has the violence been?
Well, the situation has been deteriorating. It's been degrading for the past few months. Last example, in Niger, the attack in Chinegodar, where 89 soldiers were killed in their camp by jihadists. And over the past 2 months, at least, Niger had lost approximately around 200 soldiers who died in their camps after jihadist attack. It's pretty bad. I mean, experts that I talked to in the region are really concerned. And the situation is pretty difficult because if France leaves the Sahel, it's going to be chaotic. And maybe we're going to go back to what happened in Mali 2012, 2013, when jihadists, had a huge presence on the ground and controlled almost half of the country. But on the other side, the French presence in the Sahel has to evolve. It cannot stay the way it is right now. And that's why President Macron hopes that he will have kind of an agreement with the African president at this summit in Pau.
Now, what sort of support does President Macron have for his goals here, both from G5 nations and the UN, France's NATO allies, and other nations that are concerned about what's going on, say Nigeria and places like that? What sort of support is he getting?
So one of the goals of this summit is to get international support. Basically, France would like to build an international coalition, just like the one we had for ISIS, the fight against ISIS in Middle East. And right now, it's kind of difficult because that's a wish. He would like to have the same international support. But it's pretty fair to say that France is kind of very alone in this situation because we have an international force, the UN force, the MINUSMA, in Mali already. And we have European countries and also Canada who have some troops on the ground. It could be training. It could be also some supervision. But we don't have that international involvement that we had, let's say, for ISIS. So it's pretty difficult right now for France to kind of rally other countries and also, let's say, the United States around this goal of creating an international coalition against jihadism in the Sahel.
That was journalist Nicolas Pinault in Paris speaking with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson. Kenyan police say suspected al-Shabaab militants killed three teachers today in the second attack on a school in northeastern Kenya in as many weeks. Officials have withdrawn teachers from the main town of Garissa. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Kenyan police say the teachers were killed when an unknown number of armed men attacked a school in Garissa County near the border with Somalia. Police spokesman Charles Owino says the militants also attacked a police post, but he says no officers were injured.
Today morning at about 0200 hours, armed attackers believed to be Al-Shabaab militia attacked Kamuthe Primary School next to Kamuthe Police Post. And they destroyed, they actually attempted to destroy a telecommunication mast, and they also murdered three teachers.
As police began a search for the attackers, Garissa County education officials, with the help of the national government, withdrew teachers from the schools perceived to be too dangerous. Khalif Sheikh Isaac is the Garissa County Education Chief.
The center was attacked. The market center was attacked, the entire market center. Police was burned, police camp. The Safaricom mask was also burned. Then they also attacked the school. They went and picked on non-Muslim teachers. And three were killed, one is injured. And the remaining teachers, we advised them to come to Garissa. So we picked most of them. All teachers in this county now are going to be assembled in Garissa for further advice and deployment elsewhere where there's security.
Hassan Omar is a member of the County Assembly of Garissa. His constituency falls under the area that came under attack.
The most safe place in Garissa County was this line, Bura district, the line especially. Most of the teachers were the previous thing to be transferred. Now, if it is that area has happened, now it shows nowhere safe in Garissa County.
On January 7th, at least four students were killed and four more injured when Al-Shabaab militants attacked another primary school in a remote village of the county. Security officers have been accused of not providing enough security to protect the teachers and the school. Garissa County Commissioner Mary Mwangi told VOA the government has not abandoned its people. He calls on locals to help the police with information.
It's unfortunate because they are dealing with the innocent locals, and we, as the government, we are inquiring and asking the members of the public to help and to assist the security agencies with information, so that these kind of activities can be reduced.
In just over a month, Al-Shabaab has been blamed for attacks that killed at least 23 people in Kenya, including an attack on a military base that killed three Americans. The militant group wants Kenyan troops to leave Somalia, where they're helping the Somali government maintain security and fight Al-Shabaab. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
A senior Libyan official says the head of Libya's UN-recognized Government of National Accord, GNA, Faiz al-Sarj, and his rival, Khalifa Haftar, commander of the Libyan National Army, LNA, are expected to sign a ceasefire agreement in Moscow today. Libya's head of the High Council of State, Khalid al-Machri, said that will pave the way for reviving the political process. The GNA and Haftar's LNA agreed to a ceasefire arranged by Turkey and Russia, which came into force at midnight local time Sunday, but both sides have accused each other of violating the agreement. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi discussed the role of Turkey in bringing bring about sudden international pressure on the Libyan warring sides, with Essam Omish, president of the Libyan American Alliance.
The agreements that the Government of National Accord in Tripoli have signed with Turkey brought in an actor who's able to engage other international actors, such as Russia mainly, in order to bring about a change in the Libyan status quo. I think the Europeans have failed to provide enough engagement to be able to bring about a ceasefire, but I think what eventually forced Haftar to cease his attack on Tripoli was the international will led by Turkey and Russia to enforce a ceasefire that hopefully will bring about a political engagement enough to guide Libya out of this current war.
International pressure came from all sides, including the United States. How do you explain the sudden U.S. interest in Libya?
Libya, you know, because of its geographic location, represents a very important hot area, if unstable. And I think the U.S. recognized that early, the southern border of the Mediterranean, the illegal immigration, the growth of terrorism. But really what tipped the balance, not only was the continuation of the instability, but also the Russian engagement and the spread of the Russian threat to, again, the very close shores of Europe. And I think that alarmed the U.S. enough to entice the current administration to pay attention to that region and thus increase its political engagement. That was also concurrent with the Turkish interest in the area. And I think as NATO partners, the U.S. and Turkey were able to configure an agreement that would allow them to curb the Russian expanding influence in the region. But at the same time, because of the lack of will in the U.S. to engage Libya directly, Turkey, I think, was the right conduit and was in the right timing to be the one that can do some of that bidding for NATO in lessening the influence of Russia, the pressure that was on the GNA, and the need for new partners to stop, the influence of Egypt and UAE and Saudi Arabia and even the Europeans like France because of their support of Haftar. I think it all coalesced into this new founded way out, if you may, to the U.S. to do more in the Middle East. And we are seeing really very strong U.S. diplomacy to try to change the calculus on the ground in Libya and certainly curb the Russian influence at the same time.
What's needed now for Berlin conference to lead to a political settlement in Libya?
Well, I think the challenge is this. I mean, certainly the international will was not strong enough to bring about a successful Berlin. If it wasn't for the recent, I think, role of the Turkish government and certainly the agreement with Russia. But now that that's available, I think we can see some hope in Berlin bringing about more unity to the European opinion and at the same time more unity to the international will to achieve what they have certainly spoken about in the past, starting with the ceasefire, starting with enforcing or imposing a very strict arms embargo, but then moving to the real deliverable from this potential conference, which is guiding the Libyan part to the political process. I think the challenge that we will see right now is Haftar even an acceptable member of that political agreement? Can we see even the will and the appetite for political negotiations when Tripoli is still threatened by troops that are very near the capital? Maybe we have to see more enforcement of not only the ceasefire, but rather the pulling back of all of the attacking troops in Libya. Unless we achieve something like this, I think Berlin will not become the conduit out. But I think the appetite, the will for a political solution, I think is very clear from all parts. And I think Berlin, along with the UN efforts currently and Ghassan Salam and his team, as well as other members of those who want to see a political settlement, have been working in parallel tracks, security and military tracks, economic tracks, and other civil society tracks in order to fortify and strengthen the ability to create a way out from a political settlement, which is most likely going to be similar to the national meeting that was suggested prior to all these devastating situations that led to the April invasion of Tripoli.
That was VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shenawy speaking with Essam Omish, president of the Libyan American Alliance. Cameroon has deployed at least 1,000 additional troops to its crisis-prone English-speaking regions ahead of February 9th local council and parliamentary elections that separatist fighters had vowed to disrupt. The troops are being dispatched as separatists step up violence, including the abduction of candidates. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from the English-speaking town of Bamenda in northwestern Cameroon.
This is the sound of 400 Cameroon gendarmes singing as they arrive in Bamenda from the capital Yaoundé as they vow to defend the country's territorial integrity. A similar number of armed police officers also arrived in the English-speaking southwestern town of Boya this week. One of the commanders, Colonel Henry Chinda, says the government dispatched them to make sure peace is maintained in the English-speaking northwest and southwest regions before, during and after the joint local council and parliamentary elections.
La hiérarchie tient à ce que les élections se déroulent dans des conditions.
He says the government of Cameroon is strongly committed to ensuring that the elections take place in total peace and serenity all over the English-speaking regions, and the troops have been sent to protect candidates, each and every civilian, public buildings and electoral material. He says they are asking civilians to have confidence in the troops, especially now that the crisis is gradually coming to an end. Cameroon's military confirmed that besides the 800 gendarmes, about 500 military personnel have been deployed this week to ensure peace during the elections. The troops are arriving after at least 100 English-speaking candidates have resigned amid separatist threats and attacks on them and their property. The whereabouts of others are unknown, but separatists have on social media claimed their fighters abducted candidates and promised to free them after the polls. Dennis Kemlemo, spokesperson for the opposition Social Democratic Front that has its headquarters in Bamenda, says many of their candidates are on the run.
We are having a lot of attacks. Most of the candidates of Santa are on the run. SDF candidates are on the run. The SDF is immune to intimidation and blackmail because we are used to that.
Kemlemo said the SDF must go in for the elections in spite of the threats because it believes Cameroon's parliament stands a great chance of solving the problems in the English-speaking regions through legislation. This week, the country's elections management body, ELECAM, said many of its workers in the restive regions were on the run due to threats from separatist fighters and that some of their offices in the English-speaking towns of Ndou, Kumbo, and Dop have been razed by the separatists. Mervis Ndamukong, human rights activist and coordinator of the Bamenda-based NGO Center for Human Rights Protection, says the presence of the military is not an assurance that successful elections will be conducted.
We cannot continue in this explosive situation. You have teachers, you have young people, farmers, traders, scattered all over the country. People are homeless. What we need now is to see how we are going to bring back these people to live normal lives.
Some residents have been accusing the government of bringing in troops to stuff ballot boxes on the day of the polls and give an impression that many people voted. Deben Chofor, governor of the English-speaking Northwest region, says the military is there only to protect citizens.
The head of state, in his message to the nation, promised the people that he'll neglect nothing to secure the Northwest region. And for that, he has sent reinforcement to the security services. He has also supplied key equipment that will help them perform their duty all over the Northwest region.
Separatists have on social media vowed that they will disrupt the elections and warned all English speakers against participating in the polls they say are organized by a foreign government. Separatists have been fighting since 2017 to detach English-speaking northwest and southwest Cameroon from the rest of the country and its French-speaking majority. The secessionist uprising in the English-speaking regions, home to 5 million people, has cost more than 3,000 lives and forced 500,000 to flee either to the French-speaking regions or into neighboring Nigeria, according to the United Nations. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Bamenda, Northwestern Cameroon.
Schools will be opening soon in Zimbabwe, which means mandatory expenditures from school fees to uniforms and other supplies needed. Amid the country's economic woes, parents have been hard-pressed to fulfill all the financial obligations. Reporter Kudzai Zinawashi has more details.
Tafadzwa Banda is the guardian of his young sister. He says back-to-school preparations have been harsh.
It's been tough. It's been very tough because the cost of things relative to what I earn, at least, can't speak for everyone, but relative to what I earn, it's a lot. I don't know how families with multiple kids are handling this situation.
Thousands of other guardians and parents are in the same predicament, with inflation driving up prices for basic goods and schools making frantic efforts to increase their fees. Banda goes through some of the pressing costs, including food.
You're looking at uniforms, paying the new school fees, and right now, even at the school my sister's at, there's a big debate over the fees. There's a proposed amount that the school wants, and there's an approved amount. For now, every parent is paying the approved amount.
Many schools have been pondering on hiking fees to keep up with inflation, but government has put a damper on that. Professor Amon Morira is the acting Minister of Primary and Secondary Education.
I would like to confirm that there will be no fee increase in public schools. Provincial education directors, district schools inspectors, and heads of public schools should stand guided by the circular to the same effect which has been dispatched to them.
While this may be a relief to many, schools may look to increase other costs, including boarding fees and levies. The government encourages them to be reasonable to avoid the worsening circle of inflation and loss of buying power. Many schools have resorted in charging in US dollars, but Morira says this is prohibited amid the government's de-dollarization drive, and that authorities will take action against such behavior. There is also widespread anxiety if there will be any teaching when schools open, since most teachers' unions have threatened that they will not go back to work if their salaries are not reviewed upwards and pegged to the US dollar. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashi from Harare.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
This is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, slavery, racism, and colonialism fueled the emergence of Pan-Africanism. Reflections on the significance of Pan-Africanism on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.